Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 28, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone. Today we'll be discussing the American Express versus Italian Colors restaurant case, argued yesterday in the Supreme Court, and will feature Mr. Tom Hungar, who attended oral argument. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note, as always, that all expressions of opinion are those of our expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from Mr. Hungar of about 15 to 20 minutes or so. He's going to give some background on the case, procedurally and so forth. It's complicated but interesting, and then he'll take your questions. Thomas G. Hungar is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher and co-chair of the firm's Appellate and Constitutional Law Practice Group. He is very accomplished, having argued, at least so far, 24 cases in the Supreme Court, so he's very well situated to tell us about yesterday's argument in the American Express case. And with that, Mr. Hungar, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks very much, Dean. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the case, which was certainly an entertaining and interesting oral argument yesterday. As I'm sure those on the call are aware, the case presents the question whether and in what circumstances courts will enforce arbitration agreements that include class action waiver provisions when the underlying claim is one based on federal law. Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act makes agreements to arbitrate valid, irrevocable, and enforceable, save upon such grounds as exist at law or in equity for the revocation of any contract. And in 2011, construing that provision, the Supreme Court held by a 5-4 vote in the Concepcion case that the Federal Arbitration Act prohibits the states from conditioning the enforceability of arbitration agreements on the availability of class-wide arbitration procedures. So Concepcion struck down a California rule adopted by the California Supreme Court that had effectively barred class action waivers in arbitration agreements involving consumer claims. This case involves the next question under that doctrine, or a different twist on that issue, because the underlying claim arises not under state law, but under federal law. And the Court of Appeals in this case held that the what it referred to as the federal substantive law of arbitrability invalidated a class action waiver provision in the context of federal claims. As Dean suggested, the case has an unusual and somewhat convoluted procedural history. It involves a Sherman Act antitrust class action that was brought by retailers against American Express for alleged tying violations relating to its credit card agreements. The plaintiffs seek to represent a class of all merchants that accept American Express cards. They claim that American Express engaged in an illegal tying scheme in violation of the antitrust laws because it charges its premium rates while requiring merchants who want to accept its charge cards, like the American Express corporate card, to also accept its credit and debit cards. The theory being that the charge cards, which require holders to pay off the balance every month, are used by business and well-heeled individuals who tend to buy more expensive things, and so it's a particularly attractive demographic to reach, which enables American Express to charge higher fees, but then American Express attempts to, if you will, extend its alleged monopoly by requiring merchants to agree to honor all American Express cards, including the charge cards that don't necessarily bring with them the same appealing demographic. So the lead plaintiff in this case is Italian Colors, a restaurant located in Oakland, California, that according to its website specializes in traditional as well as California/Italian food. I'm not sure what California/Italian food is, maybe organic arugula pizza or something. But in any event, the plaintiffs, with Italian Colors as the lead, filed this lawsuit in New York in 2003. American Express moved to compel arbitration pursuant to the arbitration clause in its agreements with all merchants that accept Amex cards. And the plaintiffs responded by arguing that the arbitration clause is invalid, or at least that the class action waiver provision in the arbitration clause is invalid, because that provision makes it impossible for plaintiffs with claims like those at issue here to vindicate their federal antitrust claims. Because in order to prove their claims, they say, they would have to hire an economist and prepare an expert report that would cost at least $300,000 and probably $1 million or more, according to their expert declaration that they submitted in the district court. Whereas they say the average class member in this retailer class could only expect to recover maybe $5,000 on the tying claim, and even the largest named class member could only expect to recover maybe $40,000 or so, far less than the expected cost of an economist's report. So the district court compelled arbitration, nonetheless, notwithstanding this showing, and dismissed the case. Plaintiffs appealed, and in 2009, the Second Circuit reversed in a decision joined by then-Judge Sonia Sotomayor. The panel relied on a line of Supreme Court cases holding that the Federal Arbitration Act permits arbitration of federal claims, but seeming to, at least in dicta, or arguably in dicta, seeming to qualify this rule by suggesting that it applies so long as the prospective litigant effectively may vindicate his statutory cause of action in the arbitral forum, because in those circumstances, the statute will continue to serve both its remedial and deterrent function, notwithstanding the referral to arbitration. The Second Circuit panel also relied on a statement in a recent Supreme Court case called Greentree Financial against Randolph, which said that a party seeking to invalidate an arbitration agreement on the ground that arbitration would be prohibitively expensive bears the burden of showing the likelihood of incurring costs at that level in the arbitration. The Second Circuit held that the plaintiffs had met that burden here because of their affidavit showing that the cost of hiring an expert would be prohibitive compared to the expected value of the typical small merchant's claim, meaning that if the class action waiver provision were enforced and they were required to arbitrate their claims, American Express would, in effect, be entitled to a de facto immunity from antitrust liability, which the Second Circuit said was impermissible. So they invalidated the class action waiver clause. So after, this was in 2009, after that decision, the Supreme Court decided a case called Stolt-Nielsen, which held that parties to an arbitration agreement can't be forced to engage in class arbitration procedures if their agreement didn't provide for that. And in light of that decision, the Supreme Court vacated the Second Circuit's 2009 decision and remanded for reconsideration. On remand, the Second Circuit panel, now down to two judges, because of Justice Sotomayor's elevation to the Supreme Court in the interim, issued a new opinion. This was in 2011. And they reaffirmed their prior decision on essentially the same grounds, saying that Stolt-Nielsen didn't really change anything, and they hadn't really said that the parties would need to have a class arbitration. Instead, it was fine if the parties just went to litigation. Later that year, the Second Circuit decided the Concepcion case, invalidating California's rule again, that barred class action waivers and rendered them unenforceable in cases involving small claimants. So the Second Circuit panel tried yet again, issuing a third opinion in which it once again reached the same result. The panel held that Concepcion was irrelevant because in that case, there had been no showing that the practical effect of the enforcement of the class action waiver clause would be to preclude the plaintiff class's ability to vindicate their statutory rights. So that brings us up to the present, with the Supreme Court now having granted cert to review the third opinion of the Second Circuit and poised to decide whether its Concepcion decision vindicated the ability of business defendants to enforce class action waivers in arbitration agreements, even with respect to federal claims, or instead whether plaintiffs can escape such provisions and can avoid arbitration whenever they can show that individual litigation or rather individual arbitration of their federal claims would be prohibitively expensive. So the oral argument was yesterday, as Dean mentioned. Both sides are represented by very experienced counsel. Michael Kellogg argued for American Express. The plaintiff class here, interestingly enough, is represented by Paul Clement, the former Solicitor General in the Bush administration, who I never would have pegged for a class action plaintiff's lawyer, but private practice makes strange bedfellows sometimes. And the Obama administration also appeared in support of the plaintiff class, represented by Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart. The arguments got off to a bit of a slow start because the case argued immediately prior to this one was the very high-profile challenge to the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And after that case, the argument in that case was finished, the courtroom almost entirely emptied out. And Justice Sotomayor also walked out because she'd been on the original panel below and so is recused from this case. After the exodus was over, the Chief Justice said, well, at least we're still here. And the argument then began. So Michael Kellogg, arguing on behalf of American Express, met pretty quickly with some very skeptical questions from Justices Ginsburg and Kagan, who were pretty clearly doing all they could to refute and attack his arguments. Of course, they were two of the four justices in dissent in the Concepcion case, so that was not a big surprise. And there's not really any doubt about where they stand. Interestingly, and I think somewhat tellingly, as the argument progressed, and they seemed to be the only two justices who were clearly supportive of the plaintiff's position, they began arguing in various ways for rationales that would try to narrow the question presented, suggest that maybe this wasn't a good vehicle, that not all the relevant issues were properly preserved, which suggests that they were trying to do damage control, perhaps, given the way they may have been reading the tea leaves. But more significantly, and perhaps more problematically from the from American Express's perspective, Kellogg also got questions from Justice Kennedy and Justice Breyer about the limits of his position and how categorical a position he was really taking, whether he was arguing that class action waivers are always valid and or arbitration should always proceed despite the unavailability of a class arbitration option, or whether instead he was simply arguing a more narrow position that that antitrust rights can generally be vindicated in arbitration given the flexibility and informality of those proceedings and that no contrary showing had been made in this case. And he, I think, tried to dance a fine line and sort of argue both of those propositions. And Justices Kennedy and Breyer at least seemed to be somewhat concerned about the more categorical approach. But at the same time, they seem to have the strong impression that arbitration ought to be able to handle these kinds of antitrust claims efficiently and at much less cost than litigation. But they also both seem to be somewhat troubled about the relative sparseness of the record below, other than the declaration from the plaintiff's expert talking about how much it would cost to do an economist's report to litigate a tying claim like this. There really wasn't anything else in the record about what sorts of things could or might be done to make such claims able to be litigated on an individual basis in arbitration. During his argument, Michael Kellogg, on behalf of American Express, kept sounding three major themes, I would say. First, of course, relying on the Concepcion case and emphasizing that it holds that the Federal Arbitration Act prohibits courts from conditioning the enforceability of an arbitration clause on the availability of class arbitration, and that was essentially what the Second Circuit had wrongly done here. He also repeatedly emphasized the point that arbitration is flexible and efficient, and arbitrators have wide discretion to allow claims to be and ensure that claims are able to be resolved in a low-cost, informal, and flexible manner. And that he also repeatedly sounded the theme that the Second Circuit's rule and the rule that the plaintiffs urge, which essentially requires an upfront assessment of the feasibility of litigating individual claims in arbitration as opposed to a class process, he said that that approach would be unworkable because courts would have to decide at the very beginning of the case before even ruling on the motion to compel arbitration, what the discovery and expert costs would be in the case, how much the claim is worth, what the chances of success are, and then make some sort of a cost-benefit analysis to try and figure out whether a rational plaintiff would want to pursue the claims as individual arbitration claims. And moreover, this would lead to the very odd result that the more complex and difficult and dubious the claim, the costlier to prove it, and therefore the more likely that the plaintiff would be allowed to escape arbitration because no plaintiff would be willing to bring such a speculative or dubious claim as a single claim in arbitration because the prospect for success is low, and even if they win, they wouldn't recover much money. So the counsel for the plaintiffs, on the other hand, attracted fairly skeptical questions from Justice Scalia, the Chief Justice, and probably to a greater extent than Kellogg, from Justices Kennedy and Breyer, although they were certainly equal opportunity questioners. And, of course, also drew some support and softballs from Justices Kagan and Ginsburg. And his themes were primarily sounding the effective vindication doctrine, as he referred to it. That is, these statements, arguably dicta, or at least the significance of them is a little unclear from the prior Supreme Court precedents, but these repeated statements in Supreme Court cases noting in cases where they had enforced arbitration agreements requiring arbitration of various federal claims, including antitrust and securities claims, that the arbitration process would not leave these federal statutory claims unvindicated because the arbitral forum was capable of effectively vindicating the claims. And of course, his argument was that while that was true there, it's not true on the particular facts of this case, given the high cost of litigating such a claim on an individual basis. He also repeatedly argued that, in a sense, the case should be decided on the basis of a failure of proof on the part of American Express because the plaintiffs had put in their declarations showing the high costs of litigating the case on an individual basis and the unfeasibility of doing so, and American Express had failed to challenge that showing. And he also attempted to persuade the court that he was not arguing for a broad rule invalidating class action waivers generally, rather just for his effective vindication doctrine, which meant that on the particular facts of this case and in light of the particular terms of the American Express arbitration agreement, which doesn't provide for sharing of costs, of expert costs, if the plaintiffs win and has confidentiality provisions that he claimed would make it difficult for claimants to share costs among themselves, that in light of these circumstances, in this particular case, the class action waiver should be deemed invalid and the arbitration clause unenforceable. So that's a kind of an overview of the argument, and I can give a bullet point summary of where I suspect the justices are going to line up before we turn to questions. Certainly, as I indicated, Justices Ginsburg and Kagan seem quite clearly in the plaintiff's camp, as is consistent with their vote in dissent in the Concepcion case. Justice Scalia and the Chief Justice, I would say, seem pretty strongly in the defendant's camp. Interestingly, Paul Clement, arguing for the plaintiff class, clerked for Justice Scalia, and Justice Scalia probably was his sharpest questioner, and they had a number of fairly sharp exchanges. Justice Thomas did not ask any questions, as is his usual custom, but he actually wrote an interesting concurrence in the Concepcion case, in which he took arguably a harder line than the rest of the majority. Because of his views of preemption, and he's not a fan of implied preemption, and Concepcion, of course, was a preemption case, and so he wrote to explain why he was voting to strike down this state law rule, notwithstanding his somewhat narrower views of preemption. And he explained that he reads Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act, which generally declares arbitration agreements enforceable, as prohibiting the invalidation of an arbitration agreement or provisions in an arbitration agreement based on public policy grounds, like the public policy grounds stated by the California Supreme Court in adopting its rule that it would basically violate the public policy of the state of California to enforce an arbitration agreement where it would render a state law claim effectively unvindicated because of the high cost of vindicating it in arbitration on an individual basis. Justice Thomas said that's just not an available ground per se for invalidating an arbitration agreement, because Section 2's grounds for invalidating an arbitration agreement are limited to things like fraud and mutual mistake that go only to contract formation and not to public policy grounds for invalidating a contract that has been validly formed. And so that suggests that he would apply that same principle, which didn't seem to be based on the state versus federal nature of the claims in Concepcion, but rather on the distinction between contract formation defenses and defenses based on public policy. And since the argument here is essentially an argument based on public policy, that is, the policy of the antitrust laws would be violated if defendants were enabled to escape liability by forcing claimants to bring individual claims that the claimants choose not to bring because it's too expensive to pursue them on an individual basis. So that suggests that Justice Thomas also would be very likely to vote for the defendant here. Justice Alito is a little hard to assess because he only asked one question, and that was of Michael Kellogg, counsel for American Express. It seemed to be a slightly unhelpful question for the defendant. He asked whether the rule might be different here in light of the fact that the nature of the plaintiff's claim is that they were, in a sense, coerced into agreeing to carry the American Express credit cards, which they didn't really want to carry to accept. They only wanted to accept the American Express charge cards to get that more valuable demographic, and that this is, in a sense, a type of coercion by virtue of the tying. And therefore, I think the implication of his question was, this seems like sort of a contract formation defense. But Kellogg responded by saying, that's not the issue in front of the court. That's not in the question presented. That's a separate question that was raised below but isn't here, and Justice Alito did not return to it. And certainly the fact that he wrote Stolt-Nielsen and was in the majority in Concepcion suggests that he would be likely to vote in favor of the defendant in this case also. And so finally, that leaves Justices Breyer and Kennedy, and if you're counting, there seem to be four likely votes for the defendant, two likely votes for the plaintiff, and of course Justice Sotomayor is out of the case. So either Justice Breyer or Justice Kennedy would need to vote with the defendant in order to provide the necessary fifth vote to reverse the Second Circuit decision. Both of them, I think, are likely to vote for some form of reversal or vacater. They certainly seemed very uncomfortable with and skeptical of the plaintiff's position, but they also seemed troubled by the more categorical version of American Express's argument. So I think, and this is obviously very difficult to assess and no way of knowing it, it's always difficult to try and predict how things are going to go based on oral argument, because sometimes the justices are simply thinking out loud or playing devil's advocate and end up voting a way quite different from what you would have guessed based on the argument. But to the extent one can make predictions based on the argument, I think the most likely outcomes are either a reversal of the Second Circuit and with indications to the effect that the evidence that the plaintiffs put in this case was not sufficient to overcome the presumption that arbitration will be, because of its flexibility and efficiency, will be an adequate forum for vindicating the rights at stake, and that, and in particular because the declaration that the plaintiffs put in did not specifically focus on the cost of an arbitration as opposed to just the cost of litigation generally. Or alternatively, a reversal or vacater of the Second Circuit's decision on the ground that the Second Circuit was wrong to say the arbitration agreement is unenforceable in light of the class action waiver, because that's inconsistent with Concepcion and the reasoning there, coupled with a remand for further proceedings on whether there might be other provisions of the agreement other than the class action waiver that could be excised or modified in order to ensure effective vindication of the federal rights. This was something that Justice Breyer in particular pressed on at a number of points, trying to figure out whether there was something else, something less drastic than invalidating the entire arbitration agreement or the class action waiver that would suffice to ensure that the claimants could vindicate their rights on an individual claim basis in arbitration. And some of the things he was asking about were maybe removing or modifying the confidentiality provision to the extent it might prevent claimants from pooling their resources to obtain the necessary expert report, or perhaps seeing if American Express would agree to some sort of cost-sharing provision in the event the claimants prevail. But so the bottom line from my perspective, I think, is that the Second Circuit decision is not long for this world. And with that, I'm happy to turn it back over to Dean and happy to take questions.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a great presentation. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Mr. Tom Hungar, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, our phone lines are open. If you want to indicate that you have a question for Mr. Hungar, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. The phone lines are open. While we're waiting to see if audience members have questions, let me ask you to say a few words, if you would, about the practical implications of this going forward. You know, I guess you could take it in regardless of which way or either way the court would come out, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, I think, it's clearly a very important case. If the court were to affirm the Second Circuit, which, as indicated, I think is unlikely, that would have a huge impact because, particularly in light of the Concepcion decision, the general thinking has been that class action waivers in arbitration provisions are going to be enforceable and are an effective means, in many cases, of limiting the burden and exposure posed by class action litigation and allowing businesses to have more manageable ways of handling claims arising from business activities or from employment relationships and that sort of thing. If the Supreme Court adopts the more categorical position urged by American Express, on the other hand, and basically says these are valid with respect to federal claims altogether, that would, I think, also have a pretty significant effect and would be likely to increase the trend that I think is already occurring of more and more businesses and employers entering into arbitration agreements that include class action waivers.
Very good. But it sounds like there might not be a majority to vote for the categorical sort of conclusion.
I think that's right, yes.
Okay. Once again, if you have a question for Tom Hungar, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see, again, if there are questions from the audience, let me go over our program tomorrow. We have a Teleforum conference call scheduled tomorrow. Looking at a report entitled Al-Qaeda in America, a report on terrorism events. That's going to be tomorrow at 1 p.m. on this same telephone number. So if you're able to join us, please do for that telephone conference call. For next week, we're putting together a slate of calls. I'd urge you to check with the Federal Society's website for a schedule of upcoming calls. Looks like we have one caller question at this point, so let's go to our first caller.
Mr. Hungar, thank you for providing us with this analysis. My question is, in your opinion, how do you think the justices' conception of how arbitration works compares to the reality and the practicalities of arbitration for lawyers who are actually practicing? And what I am thinking of here are some of Justice Breyer's comments regarding all you need to do is get a knowledgeable arbitrator and these problems go away, and some of Justice Scalia's comments that seem to not fully comprehend some of the expenses associated with arbitrations, including the actual expense of the arbitrator himself. Thank you.
Yes, that's a great question. And Justice Breyer and Justice Kennedy also seem to display pretty strong views that arbitration is extremely simple, extremely informal, extremely straightforward. And I mean, Justice Breyer on multiple occasions said, in essence, "Oh, I could be your arbitrator. I could do this very efficiently. Most of the issues would just be resolved, and there'd be one minor factual dispute to be resolved, and that would be very inexpensive." And at another point, he suggested, when Paul Clement was arguing that, he was referring to a brief by a leading antitrust professor, Herb Hovenkamp, who had said, you can't litigate a case like this without an economist report. Breyer interrupted to say, "Well, we just have Hovenkamp be the arbitrator." So there certainly did seem to be something of a view that arbitration is extremely simple, extremely informal, and that you have typically have or always have expert, not highly knowledgeable arbitrators resolving claims like this, which I suspect at least is certainly not always the case, and may not be the case very often in the typical kinds of arbitration that one sees in consumer cases. And they also It may reflect a lack of familiarity with litigation costs more generally. They seem to be quite skeptical of the notion that an economist's report in an antitrust case on a tying claim would need to cost somewhere between $300,000 and $2 million. And it's probably true that you could do it for less if you were really litigating an individual antitrust claim. But there did seem to be maybe a lack of familiarity with certainly the way that complex antitrust cases tend to be litigated in this day and age.
Very good. A final call for questions from our audience. Our lines are open. If you have a question for Tom Hungar, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting for that, maybe what could be a final question, let me ask you, Tom, if you want to broaden the discussion and talk about the what seems to me a plethora of class action cases in the court. I don't know if this is just me or if you've made the same observation that the court seems to be taking an awful lot of class action cases. What does that say about the court, if anything, in your mind?
Yeah, I think the court certainly has been taking an increasing number of class action cases in recent years. Obviously, the Walmart against Duke's case from a couple terms ago, which was hugely significant. This term they have, in addition to this case, the Comcast case, another important class action case, and they just decided, I think it's the Amgen case yesterday, involving class action issues in the securities context. So I think it's fair to say that the court is indicating an increasing interest in class action cases, and I think that is probably just part and parcel of their interest in issues of importance to the litigation system and particularly to business and the impact of litigation on business. I know there are some commentators out there who suggest that this is a pro-business court. Usually those are commentators who aren't themselves pro-business, complaining about the court's jurisprudence. I don't think it's really fair or accurate to call the court a pro-business court, but I think it is accurate to say that this is a court that is more interested in issues that are of significance to business than maybe some of the past courts. The Chief Justice was essentially a commercial litigator for many years, obviously at the appellate level, but representing businesses against each other or against the government or against other private parties, and has, so he spent most of his career doing that kind of work, and I think he is interested in it. Whereas I remember a former head of the antitrust division at the Justice Department saying that Chief Justice Rehnquist had an abiding lack of interest in antitrust and some of these issues of importance to business. So I think that makes a difference. It's a court that's interested in, that realizes the impact and importance and significance of litigation and the regulatory regimes for business, and they want to make sure that they are looking at those issues and providing the right answers.
All right. We've got another caller question. Let's go to our next caller.
Do you think there's a possibility that cert could be dismissed as improvidently granted, given the inadequacy of the record and the possibility of a 4-4 split?
So I don't. That's a great question. Certainly, Justice Kagan, I think in particular, seemed to be angling for that result as the argument went on. A number of her questions were aimed at trying to show that essentially the petitioners were trying to change the question presented. They hadn't really raised the right issue or the full range of issues in their question presented that they were now trying to get the court to resolve. They criticizing them for failing to put in evidence in the district court and for failing to challenge the Second Circuit's view that the confidentiality provision of the American Express arbitration agreement would prevent the claimants from pooling resources and pooling information and hiring a joint economic expert to keep their costs down. So she was making those sorts of arguments, I think, in an attempt to persuade colleagues that they should dismiss the writ as improvidently granted, potentially. I don't think that is likely to happen. The court, I think, has a tendency to, once the case is there, it's been briefed, it's been argued, they've invested the time in it, they want to decide the case if they reasonably can. I mean, certainly they will, on rare occasions, dismiss the writ as improvidently granted if they conclude there's just no way they can actually reach appropriately the issue that they took the case to decide. But I don't think that's the case here. Justice Scalia vigorously fought back on the question of whether the case was properly before them and whether they could decide the issues that they had granted cert to decide, going back to the question presented as it was actually stated and arguing pretty forcefully that it clearly was properly in front of them. Even Justice Breyer at one point seemed to suggest that they could agree with American Express on the question presented. That is, the presence of a class action waiver does not justify invalidating the arbitration agreement, but then send it back for further proceedings to figure out whether there were other adjustments that could or should be made in order to ensure that the arbitration process would allow vindication of the federal claims. So I don't think that if there's a decision, it will be to dismiss the writ. I think it's certainly always possible that it could be affirmed by an equally divided court because of the fact that Justice Sotomayor is out. But I think that also is unlikely, given my guess that there are 4 votes that seem pretty solid for American Express, and both Justice Breyer and Justice Kennedy seemed to be leaning in that direction, although, again, one can never know for sure from oral argument. But my guess is we will see a 5 or 6 justice based vote to vacate or reverse.
Thank you very much.
Let's take another question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that there is another party implicit in cases of this kind, namely the court itself, because class actions are largely for the convenience of the court, and it's certainly possible they might not call it a class action, they might call it a joinder to consolidate cases on their sua sponte without, you know, and without regard to whether there are any waivers or agreements on the part of the litigants.
Well, I'm not sure I follow the question there. I mean, certainly here, with respect to the plaintiffs that have signed arbitration agreements with American Express, if those agreements are enforceable, the courts are going to have no role other than sending the cases to arbitration. There was an interesting point that Justice Scalia kept raising, although Paul Clement for the plaintiffs was resisting this assertion, but Justice Scalia was arguing that under the plaintiff's view, which would require a determination up front before ruling on whether to send the case to arbitration, the plaintiff's view would require a determination of whether the claims could be litigated individually in a cost-effective manner in arbitration. Justice Scalia said, well, you would need to also determine whether the case would be certified as a class if it remained in federal court, because if it wasn't going to be certified as a class, then the burdens of litigation on an individual basis would be even greater in federal court than they would be in state court. And therefore, under the plaintiff's rule, you would have to be requiring class certification decisions before you could rule on arbitration decisions, which of course would defeat the whole point of arbitration, which is to provide a prompt, efficient, informal, and inexpensive way to resolve claims. Now, it's also true, as I think the question suggests, that even if there isn't a class action option available in federal court, there is the joinder option, at least for a limited number of plaintiffs. And one of the points that the plaintiffs are making in this case is that even if there isn't class action, and even before the class action option was available, which was true for the first 40 years of the Sherman Act, there was the joinder option. And that is not available in the arbitration context, and therefore that's another reason why they say the arbitration context is more difficult for them and doesn't allow them to pool their resources in a way that proceeding in federal court would.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again breaking in. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Tom Hunger. Tom, it looks like we're out of questions from our audience, but I want to give you a chance to wrap up if you have any final thoughts you want to express.
Well, just that I appreciate the opportunity, and thanks very much to the Federal Society for giving me this opportunity.
Well, thank you for attending the oral argument, of course, and for giving us such a fine presentation. We certainly appreciate it and enjoyed it. And to our audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call, scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing terrorism in America. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.